I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is broadcaster, journalist, and author Krista Tippett. She's joined in conversation by filmmaker and Webby Awards founder Tiffany Schlein. And now join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Krista Tippett and Tiffany Schlein.
Over the years, the JCCSF has built its reputation as a place where intimate and substantive conversations with some of the world's most extraordinary people take place. These conversations have helped us define our core value as a cultural institution where diverse communities are welcomed and encouraged to wrestle with big questions. With this in mind, it's my pleasure to welcome tonight's esteemed guests. Krista Tippett has built a life of conversation, of being present, asking questions, and most important, listening. In 2014, President Obama granted the Peabody Awarding winner, broadcaster, and best-selling author of the National Humanities Medal for, quote, thoughtfully delving into the mysteries of human existence. She continues to unravel the question, what does it mean to be human, on her popular NPR program and podcast, On Being, where she has interviewed thinkers and seekers from Maya Angelou to the Dalai Lama, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks to Yo-Yo Ma. All the while, the discussions she's engaged in have guided her on her own journey, which she writes about in her latest book, Becoming Wise, An Inquiry into the Mystery and Art of Living. Appearing in conversation this evening with Krista Tippett is Tiffany Schlein, an Emmy-nominated filmmaker, author, and Webby Awards founder. Tiffany's recent films are The Science of Character, The Adaptable Mind, and The Making of a Mensch. Ladies and gentlemen, please make Krista Tippett and Tiffany Schlein very welcome to the JCCSF.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm so excited to do this interview. I have to tell you that Krista interviewed me several months ago, and it was such an amazing experience. She's like, I was like, we were doing the tango, and she was just asking questions no one's ever asked me, and finding threads no one's ever seen. And so, And during the interview, I did ask you some questions, and you skillfully didn't answer them and redirected them back to me. So now I get to ask you all these questions. So,
it was hard to keep control with you.
We're going to have a fun night. I'm going to ask her all the things I wanted to ask her. I love your work so much. There's such a authenticity and wisdom to your work. So I'm going to ask you what you ask everyone, because I'm just curious how you're going to ask it. How would you describe, in any way you want to say it, your spiritual upbringing, whether you had one or not, whatever you want to come in to that question.
Oh, well. Okay. Well, you know, one thing that's interesting. Well, first of all, I just want to say how happy I am to be in San Francisco and happy I am to be at the JCC here. And with Tiffany, who we actually just met in three dimensions for the first time, because when we had our conversation before,
it was remote.
She was here and I was there, and she was in my headphones, which in some ways is more intimate because you're just coming, you know, it's kind of like the Vulcan mind meld, right? My thoughts to your thoughts, my mind to your mind. Yeah. So I'm procrastinating here.
Can we go to that for 1 second before you answer your big question.
Okay.
But it's fascinating, the return of the podcast or the radio, just like we have so many distractions and mediums, and yet why do you think the return of this intimacy of podcast and radio is like so...
Well, I think radio is a magical medium. And it doesn't have the visuals are so captivating for us. And, you know, they're wonderful, but when you take them away, there are these other, and, you know, it's not just the voice, that there are these layers of experience that we can attend to. So, you know, what I love about radio, that it at one and the same time it's kind of an individual experience and then it is a communal experience. You are listening.
True.
It's like everyone's in the room.
Yeah.
Even though it's so private. And it's, you know, it's intellectual, it's emotional. I think it makes room actually for silence. And so what I would say is that podcasting has just made it that much more accessible and mobile.
Right.
So you don't have to be sitting, you know, you don't have to catch something on the radio or be in the car. And so then you can choose to have this experience and you can actually craft and deepen the experience by doing it when you're running or, you know, folding laundry or painting or all the things people do when they're podcasting.
I love that because there's all this research that, you know, you can connect dots more easily when you're doing kind of mindless tasks, when you're keeping your body busy. And so maybe the ideas when you're talking to people, they go in deeper.
Yeah.
When people are like driving or walking. That's interesting.
Plus you can feel noble because you've been multitasking.
Oh, I do. I feel like when I drive in front of a commute and I listen to one of your podcasts, it's just like such a meaningful ride. Like it's like I have just gone to the depths of humanity before my first meeting. Yeah. Okay, now go back to your question.
Okay. So well, I'll answer the question. So one of the things you know since you've read the book is that I actually expanded on my answer to that question when I was writing the book in a way that completely surprised me, because the obvious answer to the question of the spiritual background of my childhood is my Southern Baptist preacher grandfather, who was a hellfire and brimstone preacher, who was the towering religious figure of my childhood, who had this religiosity that was just, I mean, all about rules, and it was all things you couldn't do, and it was joy-killing. but my grandfather was a very contradictory character, or what I should say is, well, he was, but also as a child, I realized, you know, one of the things a wise person said to me, actually Sylvia Boorstein, who's from here, is that as much as we want to think that our children are listening to what we say, they're rarely listening to what we say, but they are always watching what we do. And so with my grandfather, I would say, I mean, I did take in his rules, but I took in the complexity of him, which is this strictness and also this kind of fearfulness. The world was a perilous place. It was full of temptation. It was full of danger. But he was also the funniest person I knew. He was so generous and loving and passionate, and I felt like part of his fear of, you know, the temptations of the flesh was because he was a really fleshly person. And I think that flowed into also my sense of, you know, whatever God was. But also, I've learned so much from the people I interview that has expanded my sense of what does that word spiritual mean? You know, the person who, when I asked that question about the spiritual background of your childhood, said loneliness.
Ooh.
Right? And while I was writing this book, I ended up writing a lot about the sadness in my family growing up, which, you know, doesn't make me all that special, but there's infinite variety of the sadness that can be in a family, and it marks us. And there were a lot of things. My father had been adopted at a young age, and that the story of what happened to him before he was adopted was like those places on the maps in the Middle Ages where beyond this point, you know, there be dragons. There were things we couldn't talk about and questions that couldn't be asked, but I knew, the way children know things, that these things were absolutely defining. And so one thing I've found that's magic about that question is that the spiritual background of our childhood, expansively imagined, is a place where a lot of questions live. It's a searching place. It's searching in a way that we stop being in public as we become adults. Those are often questions that we follow our whole lives long. And I realized in the act of writing this book for the first time that part of my compulsion to ask the questions that seem hard to ask, that may seem impossible to ask, goes back to, you know, that beginning for me. And it seems so straightforward in a way, and it was such a discovery.
Well, that's interesting, because the theme, and there's so many beautiful themes, but even the word, like, spiritual and God and hope and faith, I love the way you kind of showed the permeability of these words and how each person is bringing so much to that word and what do they really mean. And then there's so many words in our society that have lost their meaning because they're overused or word inflation. Or you, can you talk a little bit? I mean, even the word spiritual,
yeah,
it's like you're kind of, with all these interviews, you're exposing how much that definition is so ineffable.
And yes.
I mean, well, actually, yeah. How would you define wisdom?
You know, that it's hard to define wisdom. I mean, yeah, I think these words, actually, I think some of the words we need the most they become fraught, they become burdened by the ways we use and overuse them, so we have to realize that they are containers, right? They're containers for meaning, and we can't expect them to carry all the connotations that they carry for us. So we have to kind of create ecosystems of words and also practices
them.
And behaviors,
yes,
right? Showing, not just telling. So I don't actually know that I've attempted a definition of wisdom in the book. I mean, to me, wisdom is connected to intelligence, and it's connected to knowledge, but it's a different move. It's not mere information or mere knowledge. It has discernment in it, and it's about, you know, not just what we know, but how we apply that knowledge. And I think I've just been thinking about this week. Because I realize I've been asked, you know,
that question.
And I realize I don't have a pat answer. I think that one litmus test for me of wisdom is certainly there are people who you look at them, you're in their presence, you say that is wisdom. But I don't think it's so much a quality of possession as of, you know, the imprint that life, that voice has on the world around it. I think that's the measure of wisdom.
I mean, tackling this book after you've done so many years of these interviews, I was seeing that you were, and tell me if I'm wrong, but what I felt was that you were seeing the patterns, that you had done enough of these interviews, and I'm sure people ask you all the time about what's the common thread of all these people, and that there was these patterns that were emerging for you through all the interviews. I mean, would you say that?
Yes, but the work of distilling that was really messy. And
humans are messy.
Yeah, right. And I celebrate that, but writing this was torture. So that's what I was pursuing, is that question of what are the recurring themes, the recurring qualities in lives of wisdom and grace. And when I set out to do this, I had like 10 or 11 chapters in mind, and they would have these poetic titles, intriguing titles, and then as I worked at it and wrote a lot of bad drafts, it got more and more elemental, right? Because, you know, as I kind of wrestled this thing to the ground, I realized the point is that wisdom is something we're capable of, that it's accessible to all of us, and that it emerges through the raw materials of life, the ordinary elements of life. And so in the end, it's just, you know, these five things, you know, the words we speak, the physicality of ourselves and the world around us, love, which is so much more complicated and also so much more kind of essential then I think we, you know, we toss it around culturally. Faith, which means so many, which I think has a different definition in every life.
That's an interesting word, because right? it feels so, it's a word actually I usually stay away from in describing, but, and I was questioning why, and I think you brought up is that, I mean, it is so tied to religion in my own mind, but I love the way you unpacked it, because it's such a spectrum of definition. But we keep going with the list of faith, and then there's...
It is the most fraught word in the English language.
Do you think it is?
Well, I don't know. Maybe love is.
Well, love. Let's talk about love for a second.
Yeah.
Because love, we use it. And I love what you said when you said in so many other cultures, there's so many definitions of love.
Yes. We only have this one little word.
Like, I loved lunch. Like... That
yeah, I love. Yeah,
shouldn't be the same word that I love you, or
yeah.
like,
or even yeah. So in Greek, there's eros, erotic, romantic love, which I think is what we're talking about culturally, maybe 90% of the time, or more when we talk about love. But there's also philia, the love of friendship.
Yeah.
And there's agape, which is practical care. Practical care for a loved one or a stranger. And then in the Pali tongue, which is one of the root tongues of Buddhism, there's metta, loving kindness, which is, has this other connotation of kind of active, benevolent interest in others, and also has a psychological intelligence that... that it's important that we be compassionate and benevolent towards ourselves as well, and that somehow the measure of how we'll be able to extend that to others is also connected to how we extend it to ourselves. So, and all of that.
Would you like to try? I mean, do you think if we brought those new framing, those new words, that would help the love, the way that we interact with the idea of love?
Well, I don't know. It's kind of hard for me to imagine... I think we need a richer vocabulary of love, but I think that's. I kind of think of that in terms of practices as much as language. I think love. The thing about these words that get ruined. I mean, I think peace and justice are other words that get partisan. They get politicized strangely, and yet we can't do without them. And I think, faith is actually a word I don't use that much.
Well, now, your show used to be...
Yeah, speaking of faith.
And On Being is so much more open to me. Like,
it's spacious.
It's spacious. Yes. Like, On Being Human, like, everyone can be part of that conversation. Yeah. And I think, and I've had I wrestle with... I'm Jewish, but I used to say I was atheist. My husband's convinced me I'm more agnostic,
And then you write me an email today and say, your book is so marked up, it's Talmudic.
Yes,
and
I also, love the traditions of Judaism.
Also,
I love the tradition.
You do. I think even with the tech Shabbat that you're doing, and then when you get into your character work, you start looking at the...
I'm so Jewish, but the religion okay, the religion
thank
part
you.
And the patriarchy and... there's a lot of the words, the word God. I mean, I really struggle with that word. It closes me down in services, and I use all these different words in my head that are more open.
Yeah, well, talk about a word that's too small for whatever it is we're talking about.
Whatever we're talking about. Yeah. And I, Amichai Lulevi, who we both know, I remember he said to me, whenever your mind shuts down to that, use universe, use love, use all these other words, use the force. And he just... And when he said that, I'm in services, and I'm like, may the force know. but it helps me so much, because of course I believe in the mystery of the world and all these things, but there's just these words that just like shut a door in my in my mind.
Words are so powerful.
Yeah.
So powerful.
I love what Martin Luther King taught, his quote about love. Love without... Do you know that quote? I was like looking for it, because this is... Like,
I don't know that it's...
He says, power without love is reckless and abusive, and love without power is sentimental and anemic.
Yes.
Power at its best is love implementing the demands of justice, and justice at its best is power correcting everything that stands against love. I loved that. Yeah. I loved it, because what he did is he was He was doing what you were saying, which was juxtaposing these other words to kind of make you really think of love in this multidimensional way.
Yes, yes. And my passionate longing is for us to really work with what love can mean. We've consigned it so much to private life and to family.
Yeah.
And, you know, the mystery and the majesty of love as a force in human history and in human life is that it takes us beyond ourselves.
You're listening to broadcaster and journalist Krista Tippett, whose most recent book is Becoming Wise. She's joined in conversation by filmmaker Tiffany Schlain on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And social reformers who've shifted the world on its axis have called humanity to love. And the civil rights movement is, exhibit A. But, Martin Luther King Jr. and the people around him were motivated by this their root desire was to create the beloved community.
Mm-hmm.
And the laws and the reforms, followed from that rather than the other way around. But that business of learning to know our belonging of each other and to structure our society and our laws around that, that's the unfinished business that we are now reckoning
with. We're in it.
Right? We see it.
You were talking about civil rights movement, and you brought up the word tolerance, which I also have an issue with because it doesn't, it's like you're tolerating something.
Yeah.
It's not coming from a place of love.
No. No, it's not.
I mean, the word itself is setting up the wrong framing.
Yeah.
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 I mean, and tonight is the, there's results of the election. Which, I mean, I've been struggling this election. I'm like, what is going on? I mean, what is this all, what do you think is happening? I mean, what is going on?
What is going on?
I mean, because I think you're writing about it from this beautiful intellectual place, and the polls and the election's like, this angry place, but...
Yeah.
What's going on, Krista?
Well, I have a few thoughts on that.
Okay.
So one way I look at something like the presidential election is I'm always interested in the human condition angle.
Yes.
And what I see when I see some of the most disturbing manifestations of our national political life right now is just a huge mass of raw human fear and pain. Mm-hmm. And fear, when it shows itself in public, often comes out looking like anger.
Mm.
And there is a part of what's happening that is in fact dangerous, and we have to treat it as dangerous, but there's a lot more of it that is about pain and fear, and we're not good in this culture at standing with pain and fear and taking that in and being with it.
Mm-hmm.
We're so aware of the great existential crises of this century, but the truth is that things were a lot worse 100 years ago, right? Where you actually had governments killing
each other.
Millions of their own people and people from neighboring countries, and you had ravaging global depression. And, that kind of clear crisis with clear enemies and a clear good side to be on actually, it has its devastations, and it also engenders human greatness. Like, we know we are hardwired physiologically to deal with a crisis and with a real enemy. But what the situation we have now is we have all these vast open questions. And we have all this uncertainty. And actually, physiologically, especially the people who are vulnerable, to how that uncertainty might play out, we're not equipped. That kind of uncertainty makes us as creatures a little bit crazy. And that actually is what I think we see right now in our national political life. It looks a little bit crazy. And strangely, you know, you have... I mean, it's so interesting. Yes, there's Donald Trump. And there's also Bernie Sanders. And, you know, in my lifetime, it would have, until now, have been unimaginable we could have a socialist as a serious candidate. And I don't want to equate the, those two, but what I see in the political phenomenon right now is, you know, people are drawn to voices who say, I can tell you what the problems are. I can tell you what the solutions are. And by the way, here's the enemy. The enemy is Muslims. The enemy is Wall Street. I don't think we... I think, you know, it would be... In some ways, it would be a gift if the enemy were that clear. But there's... I don't... I think I may be making this up. I'm not sure. But I have this feeling right now that with all of our complexity, that we've reached this point, this 21st century, with this
complexity
technology that connects us, with globalization, that it's actually kind of tipped us over this edge where what we are confronted with finally and again is ourselves. And one, and it's scary and it's demoralizing and it's you know... that the places we have looked and we want to be able to look to see the way forward modeled, our national political stage, are the most broken. And that's the bad news, and I don't know if it's good news, but it's empowering news that it's up to the rest of us to create the realities that we want to inhabit now. It's not going to come from above.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting because you watch the news and it's, you know, it's playing all to the amygdala. You know, it's just
exactly.
I think it's like amygdala media because it's like fear and anger and getting your attention and saying the most sensational thing. And you know, once I had kids, I stopped turning on the news and I was really curating. I mean, I'm reading what's going on, but I just didn't have it in the background because it, you know, if you, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you're watching that, you're like, that's what our world is. And yet you go outside and people are civil and it's not this angry.
Exactly.
It's like, that's not the interactions you're having daily. And yet it's so exaggerated and amplified in the media. But I love what you said, because I definitely believe this, that all these technologies, they're just extensions of us and we're good, bad, everything in between. And it's this magnifying glass to all these emotions and it can make it travel so much quicker. It's like this central nervous system. But there are places, and I love that you brought up, you know, it's like we're not killing each other in this country. I mean, whenever you think, oh, this is so horrible, but we are like, we're doing it with words and not killing each other. But there's so many places where people are killing each other, and even in our country. And I've been thinking a lot, because I generally believe in humans. I believe we're evolving on a bigger level. But
and I love that about you.
I'm an opticist, which is optimism and skepticism combined. But if you go from that premise, and I think you believe that too, but do you think we will ever evolve past violence?
Like, be like Star Trek?
You know, I'm not a Star Trek person.
Well,
do they have no violence in Star Trek?
Well, the earliest, the Star Trek vision was that in fact, somehow the wars had gotten so terrible that we'd outgrown violence. No, I don't think we will. I don't know, maybe there is a drama to being alive, and at least right now, that drama is also what makes us interesting. So I like the analogy that the globe right now resembles... the way the image we can now see of the teenage brain.
Yes, I love that.
Which is, you know, phenomenally creative and energetic,
impulsive.
And make in places and making these incredible leaps and bounds forward, and at the very same time, as part of the same picture, yeah, impulsive, reckless, like unbelievably
reckless. The prefrontal
reckless,
cortex
destructive.
Is not connected.
Yes,
in this global
so
brain.
So it's both and.
Yeah,
that's and I, as you know, in the book, so Teilhard de Chardin,
yes.
This Jesuit paleontologist of the last century, is kind of a beacon for me of a vision for spiritual evolution. Mm-hmm.
And could you share a little bit about his
theology? He was a Jesuit, which, mm-hmm. Now Jesuits have come into their own, right? Jesuits are cool. we have a pope who's a Jesuit. Ignatius of Loyola charged his men to find God in all things, and they took that on in such an adventurous way, and Jesuits were explorers, and they were also colonizers, mm-hmm. but, and Teilhard de Chardin was a paleontologist who was there in the last century when we were verifying fossil remains of human physical evolution. He was also a spiritual thinker. He had this vision. He had this idea, which seems so prescient now. He kind of foresaw something like the internet.
The internet, absolutely.
He foresaw that the biosphere would eventually be wrapped, would be overlaid by what he called the noosphere, from the Greek for mind, which is this realm, this web of human knowledge and intelligence and artifacts. Mm. And he looked at these primitive fossil remains of early humans, and he imagined that in some generation removed from ours, they would look back at our spiritual state of being now and see that as primitive. Mm. And he believed that evolution would proceed towards spirit. Mm. And, I'm so, here we are in San Francisco and, the world that brings us all this amazing technology, and we do all this speculating about our technology becoming intelligent, our technology becoming conscious.
Yes.
Well, we are already conscious.
I know.
We are already intelligent. And as amazing as our technologies are, they remain tools. Yeah. And the question is, I think, the wisdom, which is, again, a step beyond intelligence, with which we apply and adapt and develop these new capacities. And the capacitors are so powerful, as you and I have talked about.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot at stake.
Well, I think it is interesting at this moment where I really think we're just like 5 years away from being completely connected, which is an amazing thought. And at the same time, there's such a hysteria right now about computers and artificial intelligence exceeding our consciousness,
mm-hmm.
which is, my husband, who's a professor at Berkeley of robotics, he thinks it's mashugana, just all the...
There you go, being Jewish again.
I know, I love Yiddish, but it's like craziness that people are so, they don't realize how, the brain is the most complex machine, if you will, on the planet, and he doesn't worry about this problem. But it's so interesting that there's so many op-ed pieces about computers taking over, and I feel like it's our own. It's this kind of neuroses about instead of what you're saying is like appreciating all our kind of obsession. What he thinks with robots and all of these things is it exposes all the things that make humans unique and consciousness unique.
Yes.
And if you think about the noosphere and all this whole layer that we're building towards when everyone's connected and you're going to get every different perspective tackling challenges and new insights are going to happen, I mean, I'm so excited for that moment, what's going to come from that moment. But bringing it back to kind of where we are in this evolutionary state and spirituality, or whatever word anyone wants to use, I was really interested in your writing about the nuns, which mm-hmm. I actually hadn't heard that term.
Oh, you hadn't?
No, I mean, I think
N-O-N-E-S.
Yeah. Am I pronouncing it right?
No, you are. It's just that when you say it, people think you're talking about Catholic nuns.
Oh, I'm sorry. Like, nun, like, not affiliated.
That's
sorry.
One of the problems with the
that word.
That word
doesn't
it's
work,
so awkward.
Then. Yeah, yes. So, like, nun, like, no religious.
It's an opinion poll generated category for 30% of people under 30. Right.
Which is, so there's a huge growth of people that are not affiliating, you know, with any specific religious, you know, upbringing or affiliation. And yet, I love if you can talk a little bit about where you see their role in our evolution or where we are. I think that's so interesting.
Yeah. So, I mean, in religion journalism circles, which you don't run
which
in.
Which I don't hang out in, but
that's right.
Tell us what that was like.
This is a big, well, so this came from Pew polls in the last few years, and, you know, it's a multiple choice question, and it's people who answer none when asked how they affiliate or identify religiously. And there's been all this hand-wringing and all this, you know, these headlines about, you know, religion is declining.
Well, there's a lot of that in Judaism. Like, the Jews aren't affiliating, but, like, the blanket, you watch the news, it feels like we're such a religious country that...
Yeah. And so, understandably, there's anxiety in the religious world, in all its multiplicity, but, you know... what I see is that in this moment where our technology, apart from anything else, is redefining basic things like leading and making and belonging, that once you start redefining those things, all of your institutions get turned inside out, and religion is no exception. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it should surprise anyone that people who were born in the 1980s and 90s, who came of age in that moment of incredible toxicity, where, to me, it was a convergence of a few very strident religious voices who threw themselves into the public sphere, and the journalists who handed them the microphone because they made great sound bites. You know, it was entertaining, but it was so divisive. And you know, people under 30 for whom that was their introduction to religion are allergic to religious stridency and wary of the traditions. Mm. So I think there's something really understandable and reasonable about their, their caution about identifying. But when this turns into a headline, it is, you know, again, it's about the decline of religion. And what I see in that sphere, that vast, you know, when you're talking about 30% of people under 30, I experience so much, you know, spiritual curiosity, or really theological searching that has real heft and an intellectual backbone to it. And most importantly, a deep commitment to service, like a longing and an insistence on creating a life that is of service and figuring out what that means. And I think that these nuns, N-O-N-E-S, are a 21st century equivalent. To me, they're an analogy to the original monastics, who, again, we have a Jesuit pope now, so we think of monastics as being establishment, but in fact, these monastic movements started as kind of spiritual rebels. They were spiritual renewal movements. They, in their time, saw a religious tradition, church, which they believed had grown out of touch with its own heart.
Right.
Especially that core of service. And I have this... You know, we won't be alive for me to say whether this is true, but I have this idea that 100 years from now, you know, if we're all still around, people will look back at this phenomenon that it was called the nuns and say, you know, this was a movement, this was an energy that actually reformed, renewed, brought our spiritual and religious traditions back to a sense of their own purpose. And so much of, you know, the 21st century needs what our traditions at their best have carried forward in time. Mm-hmm. Not just teachings, but practices.
Well, that's what I love, right? The kind of the art of living.
Yeah.
And I mean, what you're saying, like, it's so relevant in Judaism because so many of us are trying to reimagine. My daughter just got bat mitzvahed, and how do I reimagine this ritual, which should be filled with such meaning, and mine wasn't in the 80s. Mm-hmm. It did not, you know, how can we rethink everything for meaning and purpose? And meaning and purpose on what it means to be human, which is your whole show. It's like, what's the new practice and language to find and tools to find meaning and purpose in life that are outside of traditional structures?
Yeah.
And I love, I just felt like in your book, it was like this amazing dinner party that you were kind of hosting with all these incredible diverse minds that talked about practices for meaning and purpose, which was so wonderful.
This is Bina, KALW's series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features broadcaster and journalist Krista Tippett, whose most recent book is Becoming Wise. She's joined in conversation by filmmaker Tiffany Schlein. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
I'm sure people are so excited to ask you questions as I was. And I don't know if we can raise the lights a little bit.
Hi there.
Oh, hi.
Was there a guest that you were most surprised by, that you had kind of an expectation of one takeaway that was completely opposite, that changed your perspective dramatically?
You know, I've always been bad at the question of the one, you know, the one, like, even what was your favorite movie? I can never think of anything. Like, I can never think of a single movie I've seen in my life. And I, with the question I guess what I want to say about the surprise part of it is I do a huge amount of preparing to go into a conversation. And the point of that is actually to create a space where something surprising might happen. Like, where, I mean, that is my measure of a successful interview, where somebody puts words around something in conversation that they've never quite put words around that way before. And, I mean, I think in your... It's connecting the dots, because I have this luxury of stepping back from somebody's life and their thought and... and kind of seeing...
It's an exhilarating experience.
Because with you, it was all this work you've done on character.
Yeah.
And then also, you know, me seeing that you're also committed to the to creating character in the internet.
Yeah.
And but you hadn't actually thought of it that way.
I hadn't.
So I think a conversation is an adventure. And I think a lot of us have had the experience with writing, that sometimes the magic of writing is that you actually, in the act of writing, learn that you know things you didn't know you knew. And I think the same magical thing can happen when two people are kind of in the communion of a conversation. So there have been so many moments like that.
Hey, I was wondering if you'd be willing to share a few spiritual practices that have given meaning in your life specifically.
Yeah. Which is why that's such an uncomfortable question. And the point is also, this is such an intimate part of life to talk about, to talk about head on. I think I'm like a lot of other people, that my life has different chapters, and I'm not part of a religious community.
That surprises me.
Does it?
Totally.
I mean, I think I will be again, but right now I'm
just
not.
Just where you are, you're just feeling like your own journey, exploring it is...
Well, yeah, I mean, I will also say there's something a little bit paradoxical about this work I do now, that the kinds of ideas and questions and reflections that I do as part of my work would have been the substance of my spiritual life in part.
So that is your work.
And I interviewed once Karen Armstrong, who some of you may have read her book. She's done a lot of writing about religious history and religion in the world. And she said to me, "My work is my prayer," and that was actually really helpful for me to think of it that way. But I would say, in terms of my spiritual practice, I do a lot of yoga. And I don't think I have an especially spiritual practice of yoga. I do kind of athletic yoga. But it is spiritual for me to get out of my head and into my body. And that's something I've come to in the course of my life. And I think right now in my life, my spiritual practice is about, it just sounds so simple and corny, but it's about... really taking in the ordinary things of my life. Like, my son is about to go off to college. Just like every day with him feels so sacred right now. Mm. And, I'm a reader. I also treating aspects of my daily life as ritual, like honoring them as ritual.
So it's like paying attention.
It's paying attention.
In a deep way to the moments.
Yeah.
Paying attention to what you're paying attention to.
Hi, Krista. First, I just wanted to say that you've inspired me to start my own podcast, which is actually just me texting like a dozen of my friends weird voice memos that I've recorded. And sometimes I try to sort of like channel you. Thank you so much for that. One of the things I love about On Being is you do this really wonderful, really easy way of amplifying female voices in the world, especially in my spiritual life. Like, I feel like that brings me so much. And I was curious if that's something that you think through consciously, or if that's just sort of the flow of what inspires you and what you feel like motivated to share with your listeners.
Yeah, you know, it's not something that I'm especially... that I feel like I have had an agenda about. I think that because I am female, because I'm a woman, and actually, as it's happened, and this also wasn't planned, most of our staff is female. And so we try to be really nice to the Y chromosomes among us, because they're outnumbered. It's interesting, though. Sometimes... So... One of the things that I do care about in general, and I write about this, is that the loud and very confident voices in general get our attention for very obvious reasons, and that there's a lot of wonderful, beautiful, generative stuff happening that's a little bit more quiet, or that's a lot more quiet, and that it's important that we make the effort to listen for that and look for that, because it is also every bit as an important a part of the story of who we are and what we're capable of as human beings as what is loud, what is noisy, and what gets more attention. And, you know, at risk of generalizing, I do think there's something about women and about feminine energy that sometimes is quieter. I've been reflecting a lot. Like, I have a 17-year-old son, and it's so interesting to be raising a man. So, like, I just want to say also, I'm raising a man. I'm raising a white male. So I also, you know, I want that to be a healthy part of our collective life as well. But I notice how my son is just so instinctively appreciative of the thoughts in his head. Right? No, like, it's so, right, so... And as he gets older, it's just more true. And he'll write something, and he'll say, "Mom, listen to this." Whereas if I wrote something and I'd just written it and said, "Listen to this," it would be like, "Do you think this is okay?" Right? I'd be wanting somebody to get. And so I'm fascinated by that. But yeah, I don't know if that's an answer to your question. I want this all to be more organic, right? Mm-hmm. And I actually feel that it is becoming more organic. And even if I look at my son and his generation, even with this, you know, amazing thing that testosterone does, or if that's what it is, there's this softening, there's this opening in them to things that would have been considered to be feminine. And I also think, you know, we were talking before we came
about women. Yeah, talk about that a little.
Women are discovering, I think, a power that is also feminine. So
yeah, I mean, there's definitely what we were talking about is that it just feels like there's a lot of really powerful, strong women voices in the public sphere right now in this space. Mm-hmm. And I mean, certainly there's a renaissance in media with shows by women or directed, but in the kind of more intellectual or spiritual, or I think we were saying, kind of rigorous thinking that's not cynical, but grounded.
Yeah.
But there's definitely, there's something happening right now. I mean, and you're such a amazing part of that because you're able to broadcast these ideas. But there's something happening right now.
Yeah. But my show has been a very quiet kind of in the margins, below the radar thing for a long
really?
Time.
Until,
but
like,
I now feel like it's
out there.
I feel like something's, it's coming to the surface.
And when did that happen, actually? I'm curious when
know,
you felt.
I don't know, but it's been very, and it's, you know, it's still not, it's not, I mean, I think of it as a, you know, it's a small media project. It's not
I
a
don't think
big,
that.
Huge media project.
Oh, come on, you guys. I mean, there's many people that, like, looked, I mean, yeah, that's bigger than you think.
Yeah, well.
Hi, I'm just anxious now. I'm such a fangirl. Thank you for this opportunity for this evening and for all the work you do. That's such an oasis of, you know, civility and thoughtfulness, especially at this time. I find myself always listening to your work with a dual consciousness, one for the content of the show, but the other to just learn how to be a better interviewer. So I'm curious who you admire as an interviewer and what qualities in them you admire. Thank you.
You know, that's a hard question. Like, I admire many people, but I kind of take different things from... There's no one who kind of embodies what I wanted to be, but there are many interviewers I have learned from. And, you know, maybe I would say, I mean, just this is interesting, I've never thought about this, but maybe this is connected because I think there's a real kind of male persona to a lot of the, even the female, the classic interviewers.
Oh, that's interesting, I think that's right.
The interviewers I like, I mean, I like Scott Simon's interviews on public radio, and what I've always liked about them is it feels like he's leaning in, and that's actually unusual, right? I mean, because what you get more, the kind of journalistic pose is to be over here and to be kind of sovereign, and... something I've kind of in my, like, gently struggled against, and it's hard to get taken seriously early on, is there's kind of this reverence for the tough question. But the tough question is really about how the journalist sounds. And a tough question is often the last thing that is going to actually elicit an honest, revealing answer. It may elicit a dramatic answer. It may create an entertaining exchange. But if I'm looking for something searching and open, then my question may sound really not tough at all. But there's a psychological intelligence about, you know, not sounding tough, about creating a trustworthy, inviting, hospitable space.
Like the opening question.
Where something can happen. Yeah, where something can happen that will surprise you both.
Well, I was noticing, but now it's making sense because it's more of a journalistic, but you never, although you're talking about such intimate things, you don't usually talk about your own, you don't put forth your own personal story to open people up, but you did in the book.
Yeah, it was hard. That's why it was hard.
Yeah, but it was interesting because I was thinking, well, oh, she never does that in interviews. You never mention anything.
Well, I mention things, but it's not about me. Like, the conversation is not about me. So, I mean, so when I'm present, right? Yeah. I mean, that's the thing about being in a conversation, you're present. So I will be responding. And I mean, you and I had a lot of back and
absolutely,
forth.
Absolutely.
But I'm not at the center. And that's right. I shouldn't be at the center.
Interesting. You know, before we close, I would love for you to read from your book as a closing. This book is so good. I hope you all get it. And I had so many different passages I wanted you to read, and then I thought, I want you to read the beginning because it's so beautifully written and it really says what the book is about.
Thank you for asking me to do this because I haven't been reading from the
book.
To
read?
And
this
I haven't read this out loud,
oh, good,
ever.
Good. Oh, my gosh. Yay. Yay.
No. Okay. So, and I haven't actually looked at it for a few days. All right. I'm a person who listens for a living. I listen for wisdom and beauty and for voices not shouting to be heard. This book chronicles some of what I've learned in what has become a conversation across time and generations, across disciplines and denominations. This adventure began as the century turned and has grown and evolved along with it. My interest in these pages is on qualities of the art of living that have taken me by surprise, uprooting my assumptions. I've tried in what follows to show how my ideas have emerged conversationally through a back and forth with graceful minds and lives. I've come to understand the cumulative dialogue of my work as a kind of cartography of wisdom about our emerging world. Mm. This book is a map in words to important territory we all are on now together. It's a collection of pointers that treat the margins as seriously as the noisy center. For change has always happened in the margins across human history, and it's happening there now. Seismic shifts in common life, as in geophysical reality, begin in spaces and cracks.
Oh, yay! Beautiful.
Thank you.
Very good.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was broadcaster and journalist Krista Tippett, whose most recent book is Becoming Wise. She was joined in conversation by filmmaker and Webby Awards founder Tiffany Schlain. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espelay, Maya Finley, and Jake Gukowski. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.